Hello and welcome to A Gay Old Time. My name is Nigel May. You may know me from things I've presented on the TV. You may know me as a host from my radio shows, or you may have read one of my novels. You may not know me at all, and that's just fine. But anyone who does know me will know that I am very proud to be a gay man and hugely proud to be part of a beautiful queer community. This podcast is a celebration of that community, of its many beautiful people, people of all ages, people who have fought with their emotions and who have faced struggles and emerged victorious, who have had to tread their own path in life to live their real truth. People who inspire, who aspire, and who always entertain. People who matter. Each episode, I'll speak to a person from our LGBTQIA+ rainbow, discuss their journey and their thoughts on our rich and varied queer community. One person, one life, one conversation, and I can guarantee a gay old time. My guest today is Peppermint, a true trailblazer in the worlds of drag and transgender rights. She's an actress, singer, songwriter, TV personality and activist. When she was announced as a contestant on season 9 of RuPaul's Drag Race USA, she became the first transgender woman to come out prior to the show airing. On stage, she became the first trans woman to originate a principal role on Broadway, and her music career has seen her release many successful dance tracks that don't just bring the bop, they also bring a message of what it's like for a black transgender woman living in current times. She has starred on TV in pretty much everything, from Pose, Saturday Night Live and The Traitors, through to her own comedy special. Peppermint, welcome to A Gay Old Time.
It's so great to be back.
It's lovely to speak to you as ever. Lots to cover because you are such a busy, talented, inspirational, iconic lady. But I want to go right back to the beginning, to a young Peppermint. What are your earliest memories of sort of otherness and feeling that maybe you weren't conforming to what maybe society expected you to be, Peppermint?
Well, you know, I really do believe that queer people are born queer. And I obviously have several different identities, and I was made aware of those very, very early on. Obviously, my blackness and also my queerness. And, you know, I couldn't escape that. You know, I was drawn to the pink frilly things just naturally, you know, didn't necessarily know what to make of that, but I knew that I liked them. And then later on learned, and when I say later on, I mean like before school age, I learned from others that those things were wrong, from family members and people in the community and other classmates and people like that. So I learned really, really quickly that I was extremely swishy. I was this thing that everyone was, well, I was being called this thing that everyone was telling me that I was, which was, you're gay. And, you know, I couldn't really deny any of this queerness, right? And so that's when I realized very early on, I think for them, they were accusing me of something like sexual and feminine. But for me, it was just like naturally who I am and who I was and what I was just drawn to. I didn't really learn. I think I can remember like learning to perform femininity, watching my mother watch, like growing up. But those were like very, you know, sort of, I was cognizant of that. So that was much older, much later. I can't say that I was naturally swishy, but not necessarily performing femininity in the way that, you know, you learn to swing your hair and snap your fingers when you want to be sassy. That's not necessarily innate. I learned those from watching other people. And so, you know, it's kind of a combination of nature and nurture, I guess.
So paint a little picture for me of you as a child then. I mean, what were your aspirations at that point? Childhood heroes, you know, when you watched the TV, were there people that you thought, yeah, I'm kind of like recognizing maybe people that are like me? What was going through your mind at that stage?
Well, I mean, I was always very, I always had an aversion to sports, that's for sure. I was never, like, that was never my thing. I did like dodgeball. And I was always a very theatrical child, I think, from what I have heard from people telling me what they remember of me. I just remember like liking to have fun, and people would always tell me that I talked too much. But later on, that turns out that I was like always interested in plays and wanting to do shows in front of whoever would watch. And even like enlisting people to be involved in the show, you know, like if I needed, I remember like getting all of the neighborhood kids to play everyone in The Wizard of Oz because I couldn't play all the characters naturally. So I had to force them to do it. And so like there was a lot of that in my life. And then eventually, you know, once I became like sort of teenage, I ended up working at a couple of camps after having been a camper. I was a counselor at some of these camps. And then I just continued with that same energy of forcing everyone to be in the show. But I was able to teach the dance class. So like then we had no excuse.
So what age were you sort of aware of maybe sexuality as opposed to otherness?
I don't think I was really fully aware of sexuality until I started having like that funny feeling and that sort of butterfly and tickling, you know, whatever sensation later on as I got a little older, probably like, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then I was very much aware of like a sexuality, right? I was aware, certainly I was younger than that when I learned like what gay was, what straight was naturally. You know, I just having seen a couple of movies and a couple of Disney films and you learn what you're supposed to be and what you're not supposed to be, right? So, you know, I learned all that really young, but I obviously didn't have an outlet for it. So I wasn't able to really talk about it or exercise anything until much older, until I was in high school is when I was able to actually like express my sexuality, even though I wasn't necessarily sexually active. But before that, it was really all about just like the flamboyance of it all. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of role models. Of course, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And so there wasn't a lot of people that were out, like not like there would be role models today, people who are out and who are sort of claiming their identity. It was a lot more subversive back then for sure. And so like there was people that were like Elton John and, you know, Richard Simmons of all people and, you know, Prince, who isn't, you know, out as queer for sure, but definitely is a queer icon if you ask me, and was definitely going against sort of gender roles for sure, especially for what people would consider acceptable for a Black person, a Black man. And so those were some of the people that I was able to kind of learn from and sort of, you know, identify with temporarily.
I mean, you were raised in Delaware and also Pennsylvania as well. What were they like as states to sort of be growing up in?
Back in the day, I certainly encountered a lot of discrimination. I mean, I wouldn't call it discrimination. People would make fun of me. There was bullying. There was a lot of people that were like policing, you know, what I could and couldn't do or shouldn't do. And I would get teased at school. And so most of my experience as a young person obviously was in school, especially socially. And so that was tough. My family, you know, is probably a typical, you know, semi-middle class Black family, Democrat, you know, family in the Northeast. And so there weren't a lot of extremes in my family. And so most of the things that were like uncomfortable extremes I experienced in school, racism, you know, I'm not experiencing racism in my family, racism, homophobia, transphobia, those types of things I was experiencing in school, sort of had to learn how to deal with. And I didn't really have a support system, a proper support system at home or in any other way that would help me sort of protect myself from those things, learn about how to deal with those things, and at the same time grow in my own identity. And so I'd say my youth was all the theme of my youth was tolerance that I had to rely on for the most part, especially from my family. But Delaware and Pennsylvania, it's in the Northeast, mid-Atlantic, I guess people would say, in the United States. And so, you know, I wasn't in the Deep South. I wasn't around a lot of like, you know, what people would describe as like Trump supporters. obviously, that was a completely different era. It's gotten out of control now. But there were certainly, I'm sure, Republicans when I was, you know, growing up. But it wasn't, I didn't really operate like in fear of my life or anything necessarily, just in fear of getting like beaten up in school.
Because I read online that you were beaten up at school when you were a cheerleader. Is that correct?
I was. Yeah, I was beaten up by someone on the basketball team. I was the head of the I was the captain of the basketball cheerleading squad. And one of I won't say wasn't my basketball player, but one of the basketball players on our team that I was a cheerleader for beat me up, you know? there was a rumor going around that I liked him and had a crush on him, whatever. And that got back to him, someone went and literally walked over and told him that, you know. Then they waited for me after the lunch bell and ambushed me in the hall.
How did that make you feel? I mean, the policing that you mentioned just now and then things like that. I mean, what age did that happen? And did it make you sort of feel that you wanted to rebel, or did you feel that you wanted to go inside yourself and just sort of retreat from the world? Or was it a case of actually, I don't care what you think about me. This is who I am.
You know, it was in probably definitely more the latter. It happened in high school. And so I was obviously much more sort of formed, you know, much closer. I was an adolescent. So I probably wasn't as impressionable, but it was damaging for sure. And it was traumatic, and it did affect me. I can't say that it didn't. Just because of the way that I was raised, not necessarily the things that I was raised to think or believe, but the way that I was raised, sort of the tools that I was given, allowed me to have a really strong sense of confidence and self-confidence from a young age. And I think I've always had that. People have always sort of expressed that to me and sort of commented on it. And so it must have been there. So yes, while I was in fear, of walking down a certain hallway, or if I saw some people across the way, I would wary of them, or, you know, and I would certainly modify my behavior for protection. And, you know, if I was doing cartwheels and down the hall and I knew that the bullies were coming, I would stop doing cartwheels, right? At whatever speed I progressed in my open queerness and flamboyance, never was thwarted by any of those things. I never regressed. It just kept going. In response to the beating, I was, you know, I left. I was certainly stunned and I didn't know what to do. And I figured, okay, well, after you get into a fist fight, you get sent to the principal's office. So I guess after you get beaten up, that's where you should go to. So I just kind of got up and stumbled to the office. And I've told this story many times, but, you know, I don't understand why, but a lot of school offices, front offices are basically just made up of glass windows all the way around. So you can see all the way through. And so while I was sitting in there waiting and talking to the people, I couldn't really speak. I was kind of still stunned and not, you know, gathering myself and a little emotional. And, So the office lady, and I guess she was the secretary or whatever, was, you know, very remorseful and looking at me very tenderly. And it was obvious I had just gotten beaten up. And so, but the bell had rung at the same time that the trouncing had ended. So everybody sort of moved. They left me. I got up and walked, and then students flooded into the hallway all at the sound of the bell. So by the time I got to the office, people who would normally be walking by the office to get to their next class stopped and stared, and they could see that I was hurting and that I had just been beaten up. And I was, since I was very talkative and quite friendly, I was a popular person in the school. I don't know if that means everybody liked me, but they all knew who I was. And so word spread really quickly. And by the time I turned around and realized, there was dozens and dozens of students and also faculty members looking at me, and sort of people were crying and upset. And just, I felt this sort of circle of love around that glass office window. So whatever damage had been done had been healed almost immediately, moments later. And so that's the bigger takeaway for me, you know, that I had more people rallying around me than I had sort of trying to harm me.
One of those things that I think all of us within the queer community have as maybe a pivotal moment in our life is the famed or the infamous coming out to our friends, to our family, to those around us. Did you have a particular coming out moment?
You know, there were certainly times that I came out to people, and I can remember some of them. I think I was so bold in coming out that I probably, people recount my coming out story to them. And some of them I just don't remember. But the earliest one that I do remember when I was in second grade. And there was an exchange student, or not an exchange student, someone new, who was an immigrant, whose family had immigrated from Ireland. His name was Gavin. And I've spoken with him since, and he's okay with me giving his name. We were in second grade, and we were friendly. And I think there's just something about him being new with a new type of energy, but then also the fact that he was European and had been raised that way up until second grade. He was just a little more open-minded than the rest of the people in my school and people that were American, I think. And so he never had that pretense of like, well, I'm just going to stay away from you because I know you're different and you're queer and you're this. He just treated me like everybody else. And since he was new, maybe he was experiencing a little bit of like otherness as well. Maybe we bonded on that, but we were friendly and would often like meet up on the playground. And so there was a moment in time where I like basically came out to him. I sat him down to confess that I'm different. And he understood what I meant. He was like, I know. He was like, it's okay. And that was that. And so although the words were like, you know, we were in second grade, right? We were like 9 years old. So we didn't have the vocabulary of adults. We certainly didn't have the same vocabulary that we have today. But he knew exactly what I was talking about when I said that I'm different. And I mean, he certainly knew because everybody knew that I was different, but I was able to express it on my own terms without people like using it to tease me. I was coming out in a way. And I'll never forget that because he never judged me. We stayed, we were classmates, obviously in second grade and then for the rest of our time at that school. So for a few years more. And then in high school, again, we ended up going to the same high school later on. And he was never, ever, like, he never participated in any of that bullying energy that I had experienced at different points of my schooling.
Did you have a supportive family, Peppermint?
Yeah, they were really tolerant. And they were really supportive of me in the arts and anything that I wanted to do creatively, which does sort of intersect with my queerness. You know, there were moments where I would hear anti-queer language, homophobic language at family functions and things like that. Not like everybody sitting around screaming it, but like I would hear someone saying it like in private or to another person or sort of one-on-one in certain moments. And once or twice somebody even used that language with me. But overall, I think other people would hear things like, you know, oh, you want to be in ballet class. That must mean you're gay, you're an blankety blank, you know, an offensive anti-LGBT word. And for me, I never heard that. Like they would never criticize me wanting to do any type of art because they were all artists as well. So I could be in ballet, I could be whatever. I probably could start doing drag. They were able to separate like the artistic and creative urges that I had from sexuality. They would sometimes comment on like whether or not I was going to be gay. But that had nothing to do with me being in dance class. Like they were, it's hard to explain, but they were just really supportive of the arts because there were so many people who were artists in my family. And so like they never hindered any of that. They were really encouraging of my mother to like put me in all of the classes and clubs and different things. And they would all show up to me in the school play and all those things. Like they never, I never, so I just basically learned to like funnel all of my queerness through the arts, you know what I mean? And so that was, that's how we did it. So my family was really accepting in that way and tolerant.
Was there a journey for you of going from maybe feeling you were gay to suddenly feeling, no, actually I'm in the wrong body. It's like, I'm trans. It's like, what was the journey there?
Well, there was a moment, there was certainly many years where the word gay was sort of all-encompassing of anybody in the LGBTQ communities. We weren't using that acronym then, sure, or moniker then. Of course, I knew, like, I was assigned male at birth. And I knew that, like, if they were like, okay, separating the groups by sex, I knew that I had to go over to where the boys were. I knew which bathroom I needed to use. Of course, I knew all those things. But, like, I never, ever described myself as a man or manly or any of those things. It made me, like, nauseous to, like, even think of that. And so, you know, I never considered myself gay. I did use the term, like, we used to say the gay community, right? That was, like, how we would describe the whole community. And so I knew that I was a part of the gay community in conversation when I was trying to communicate something. It was a means to an end to communicate something to other people. But I never was like, oh, I'm a gay man. Like, nobody ever heard me say that. And what I meant when I was using those words was queer, at best was queer, if not trans. I knew that I was very femme and needed desperately to express my femness from the minute I could, like, make my own choices about anything I wanted to do. I think I really came out as trans probably to myself for the first time, probably when I was like 11, maybe, you know, which is young. And of course I wasn't like, I didn't, you know, go have any surgeries or do anything medical. I didn't even like do anything social necessarily until a few years later. But I think the first time I came out to somebody as trans, I was probably 16, 17. And so I sort of was developing the idea, figuring out and separating for myself the difference between gay and trans, because there was nobody to explain it to me very early on, like for myself for a few years. And then later I was able to sort of articulate it to other people.
Did that come about when you went to New York City and went to musical theater? Was that a case of almost like finding like a confidence, a tribe, and maybe that confidence within to sort of say to people or say to yourself, yeah, this is who I am?
I certainly wanted to move away to college, at least for the same reasons as every other young college student, but certainly because I wanted to find my own people, my own tribe. I remember deciding which schools I was going to look at and apply to just based on who was on the brochure. If I could spot somebody queer on that brochure, then I would go, I would apply. And that's exactly what I did. I only got into New York, thank goodness. So yes, when I came to New York, I landed with like fairy's wings. But that's not that different than how I left. You know, I was already like doing drag before I moved to New York. I was already living every day as a woman in Delaware when I was working at the bank. I hadn't begun any type of transition medically, but socially I certainly had. I got fired from the bank for wearing women's clothing to work. Even though I had done it every time, except for my interview, I didn't do it. But then every other time I did. And so, yeah, I wore a shirt and a tie, a smart lesbian look when I went in for the interview. But then I got fired for like having long hair and nails and all these things. And so that was way before I moved to New York to go to college. And so I was already in that sort of life before I moved to New York. But certainly when I got here, I wanted to find more people like me. And so it wasn't long before I was working in drag at the nightclub. And that allowed me to find all of the freaks and the queers.
Were there queer safe spaces for you back home? Or was your first sort of experience of queer safe spaces once you got to New York?
No, I mean, there were safe spaces. There were spaces that I found safety in. I can't necessarily say that they were like designated as queer spaces. But like I was very involved in drama class and theater. And so like the theater class in high school was a very safe space. All of the gays were there. You know, I participated in something called the Homely Court, which was a cross-dressing competition for the whole school, mostly for the cheerleaders and the football players. And I won. of course, I was using the high school drama class's costume closet. But I would like to say more than just the costumes. It was also the model. But I won. And that was with an audience of the whole school deciding that I was the winner by round of applause. And so I found moments of safety in all of these places that were otherwise, you know, the high school gym was like not any place I wanted to be. But that's where we had our costume contest thing. And that's where I won, right? And so that's where I started having dance classes. I created my own dance troupe. And we would do every Janet Jackson routine in high school. Of course, we were like in the same gymnasium as the basketball players who were beating me up, but they weren't going to shut down our dance troupe. And so I found moments of safety. I created moments of safety like that in the dance troupe. Of course, everybody in the dance troupe knew all my whole tea, and they were voguing and everybody was tra-la-la. So like that was a very safe space that we built and that we created.
How was the dating experience for you?
It wasn't. Before I moved to New York, there was no dating experience. I think I had a couple of hookups here and there, but there really wasn't, you know, it was difficult. I don't think, the dating situation is a doozy for a lot of trans women, regardless of where they are in their medical transition, social transition. With people my age, many of us who are trans ended up coming out a little later in life. And so I didn't have the like third grade boyfriend like any other girl did, you know. I wasn't able to really date until I was able to be around people who were willing to date me. And that means that they had to have sort of an understanding about what was going on for themselves. That's still in progress, I think, for a lot of, be cursed with the sexuality of hetero. And so I'm attracted to straight men, which traditionally have the least to offer in many ways, in most ways. So, you know, when it comes to social growth and understanding and introspective behavior, cisgender heterosexual men are often last in line for that kind of thing. And so that kind of puts a barrier to being able to date safely anyway. I did go on a really nice date last week, which was lovely. But in high school, it didn't happen. There was a guy that I had a crush on and I hadn't medically transitioned. So I certainly had experiences where there were guys that were my age who were either classmates or whatever, who there was an obvious attraction. But I think that probably confused them because I was in the body of someone that they wouldn't necessarily have been attracted to. But they've expressed to me so many times, these were like friends that like were flirtatious, that, wow, you know, if you weren't born the way that you were, then I'd be dating you. Like they've said that. And so clearly that was about like our connection, my personality, my essence, my vibe, whatever. They were picking up on my femininity and the woman that I am, my transness, for lack of a better way to put it. They were picking up on that. They must have been. And so that was a hindrance for, you know, like that was a deterrent for them. And certainly it hindered my dating experience for many years. Until I don't think I went on a proper date until I was like, it was way after college. I think I was probably something, probably 30. I was probably 35 before I like went out in public on a date with someone. And I didn't even start my medical transition until way after that.
Well, this is what I was going to say, because you mentioned earlier that your social transition was a very confident, a very easy one. With your medical transition, was that something that you looked at as a voyage of excitement, or was it something that there was still trepidation about? How did you sort of approach the medical transition?
I mean, looking back on it, I was like first in line when I could. There are certainly people now who that is one of the first things when they come in sort of into their trans identity. They start their medical transition right away. Or there are certainly people who view the medical transition as a prerequisite to even like claiming the trans identity. And there for now, our access to those tools, you know, much easier for now, even though there's states that are trying to block it and block access to those types of things. But for me, growing up, you know, I was able to grasp the concept that I'm a woman, but I didn't have anything that I could do about it. And there was, I think when I was very young, before I was of age to do anything about it, I was growing up in a world where doing anything about it was like only for people who were like legit rich. Like it wasn't and something that like a Black teenage trans girl could do anything about. And there definitely weren't any like social services that would support a medical transition of trans people or anything. And so at least that I had access to. And so the time that I was sort of maturing and learning about what I could do in terms of a medical transition was around the same time that everybody else was learning about it. In the moment, I did feel the trans women that I knew who had had surgeries before I did or had things before I did were all mostly getting things through the black market and a combination of black market, which was like not something that you would just get from your doctor. There's like no prescriptions. It was like, if you have the cash, meet me behind the dumpster and I'll give you this bottle and you're going to hope and pray that it's going to do what you want it to do. And there was, we heard a lot of stories that it wasn't what they wanted, you know, it had a negative impact on their health. And then there were doctors who were willing to provide surgeries for cash, which I didn't have. So like that wasn't an option. But many of the girls who were getting cash that were in my age bracket or a little older in my generation who were getting getting surgeries had access to the cash, not because they were working and saving, well, they were working, not because of their like day job, that they were getting fired from at like a convention, like a 9-to-5 or an office job or a corporate job or, you know, a retail job. They were, you know, participating in survival sex work or sex work. Some of them may have been not survival, but they were all surviving on that sex work and they were using it to pay for their surgeries and things like that, their medical transition. And that was just a route that I was trying to resist, to be honest with you. So when I, after college, when a medical transition and the notion of hormones and surgeries sort of came into my mind, the next question was how? And the option that presented itself over and over again was sex work and black market healthcare. And I just didn't want to do that, but that was really the only option. It wasn't until in New York, 2012, there was a mandate, I think around the time, like when Obamacare had like solidified itself. In 2012, our governor, now disgraced Governor Cuomo, had a mandate that trans-related healthcare needed to be covered on all insurances in New York State. And that was in 2012. I was 30-something. And I was like, oh, well, there you have it. I was 35, 36. That was my answer. And then finally I had a route that wasn't survival sex work, which was just something that I didn't want to do. And so that's why I wasn't able to really transition much earlier. I just didn't have access to it. It didn't present itself, you know. I didn't have healthcare for a long time. And so from all those years until that moment, I was really considering myself what I think I made up a word. I haven't heard it. I'm the only person that I thought heard it, that I've heard use it. Non-operative transsexual. There was pre-op transsexual, post-op transsexual, which is like where you were in terms of your medical transition and operations and surgeries. And I consider myself non-operative. I got no money for no surgery and I do no surgery and I can do it with makeup and I'm young. That only lasts so long. And so that's where I was all through my 20s and into my 30s. And then once healthcare became a thing for me in a reality, then I quickly was like first in line, so much so that I brought my a print out of the law to my doctor who had formerly refused to show him you need to do this. The governor says it. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Did it take the transitioning, the medical transitioning, to finally make you feel comfortable in your own skin? I mean, was that once that journey was done, was it very much a feeling of like, yeah, now I can begin the true journey of my life?
Well, I always had a sense of comfort and self-assurance, as I mentioned before. And so I think anybody who was around me, certainly people who knew me prior to my medical transition, would pick up on my sort of confidence that I had. But looking back on it and in hindsight, yes, I have never felt more myself than I do now. And there's still somewhere to go, you know, because I think we're all sort of evolving and changing and growing and learning lessons and that life has to teach us. And I think all those things, whether it's a medical transition or taking care of our health just in general, or our mental health or our social situation, whatever, you know, our living situation, our work situation, any of those things, taking care of all those things and making sure that they're like aligned and tidy, I think brings us closer to like feeling our most full selves and getting the most out of the life that we have to live. And certainly my medical transition was a big part of that. Yeah. And so certainly having access to medical professionals that would treat me and care for me and understand the importance of, you know, trans-related healthcare was what I would say life-saving for sure, because I can't imagine having gone on another 10 or 20 years without having access to those things if they were like illegal or I had to get them through some shady person. Or maybe the person wasn't shady. Like the person by the dumpster was providing healthcare to people who needed it and that's the only way that they had to get it. But, you know, I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have the options that I ended up being able to take advantage of.
I want to ask you about one of the many joyous moments that you've given to the world, because, you know, you will go down in history as always the first open trans woman to be on RuPaul's Drag Race. I mean, that when you look back now, that must be, you know, you must think, yeah, that was a moment. Do you know what? I did something then.
You know, I do feel I would like to think that I'm really happy and proud when I look at shows like RuPaul's Drag Race now. Especially considering that RuPaul's Drag Race is a leader and on the forefront of so many things and is so closely associated in people's minds with the LGBTQ community and creativity and all those things that I love, obviously drag. And, you know, clearly there was a component missing for so many years with regards to the show. And now looking at where it was versus where it is now, I'd like to think that I had, an effect, an impact on that. There certainly are trans women who were on the show prior to me, but they weren't necessarily out on the show while they were filming during the time. And so that is a distinction that I'm really proud about. But it also sort of highlights for me how few opportunities there were. I mean, if you look at it now, there's many people who were formerly on the show at one point who have since come out as trans. And, you know, I don't know necessarily specifically what was going on in their personal lives that would have stopped them from feeling free enough to do that. I can certainly understand it because I was in those places at one point in time. There was sort of a cloud over the experience and the notion of going to audition for the show and then the thought of getting on to the show that sort of made it difficult to see myself as out and trans on the show because I hadn't really seen that included in the way it is today. So I do feel proud, you know, sorry for that long answer. I mean, of course I feel proud. I'm really happy that I did the show and I'm grateful for the experience that I had on the show. There were some considerations, I didn't speak about being trans before going to the show with any of the producers or people that I had in any interactions with. There really wasn't an opportunity to, and they didn't ask on the application form. So I just said, when I get there, I'm just going to like be out and trans. And if anybody has a problem with it, then we're going to have a problem. And so that was kind of the way that I went into the show. And then you know, come to find out, I didn't need to do that because we were having, I've talked about this before too, we were having a conversation about like gender fluidity and all these different things, which are very progressive. On my season, the other girls were sitting around talking about that, which really made me feel very comfortable to disclose to those girls that I was trans, even though I had come out to individuals in my life, like obviously starting in second grade and then started my medical transition like 3 or 4 years before that. I didn't know if people, the conversation about transness as related to drag in 2015, 2016, around the time of season 5, 6, 7, was kind of vitriolic. It was not very healthy. It was not very, in terms of Drag Race, it was a conversation on social media that was like pitting the gay community who were fans of Drag Race against trans performers who wanted to either be on Drag Race or also wanted, were also performing in the context of drag. It pitted gay people and trans people against each other online in a way that was just really nasty. And I heard some really, really terrible things said about some of the trans women who had come out after the show. And it wasn't very welcoming, you know? And so I was going into it feeling like, okay, I might be up against some of the same energy that I'm seeing online right now. But I was like, I have to be myself.
You were beautifully yourself. And what I love about, you know, the fact that you were successful on RuPaul's Drag Race is the fact that it allowed us, the world, to experience your eloquence, not just in your conversation, but also in your music as well. I want to talk about your music because you always seem to put out music that has a message. I mean, a personal favorite for me was Blend with the fantastic Caswell. I mean, that was a, you know, that wasn't just a bop. That was a song that had a very strong message behind it. It seems to me that whenever you put music out there, it's always from the heart, Peppermint.
Well, thank you for that. You know, music for me is a part of my DNA for sure. And I'd always wanted to be authentic with the music because I always was paying for it myself out of pocket as an independent artist. And so just really from an early age, I was like, well, if I'm going to pay for it and have to do it, then I'm going to say what I want to say. And I just always felt like I had a lot to say. There were moments in time when the music that I had put out was a little more coded in its language very early on, you know, which a lot of songs are, you know, so cryptic, sometimes you just don't know exactly what they're about, but you know how they make you feel. And so that was my first few songs, my first few like releases. But then since then, it was always really important for me just to speak really directly, especially since there was an outlet. When I first, within a couple of years of creating music, I'm going to talk about like nobody's ever heard of it. There was a channel called Logo that showed that was in the United States. That's a channel that obviously aired RuPaul's Drag Race initially, but they had other really great programming before RuPaul's Drag Race, all queer programming. And so they had a music show because it was related to MTV. It was an MTV channel. They had a music program and they were like, we need all your gay music, so send it. So I was like, well, I have this music. Now we need to make a music video so that we can like show the world the music. And so they treated me as if they loved me down there at Logo. And so I was like, y'all, oh, you want another music video? So I would go and I would film, I would save up money to make a music video just to put on Logo because we weren't really, it wasn't a thing like that with YouTube. The way it is now. And so it was all about, if you wanted to see queer music nationally, you needed to tune into Logo. And I had people that, I got bookings around the country from people who, because they saw me on the click list on Logo. And then there was a few other shows, I can't remember what they were called, you know, which was kind of like Logo's version of TRL. So yeah, I was able to have a platform. And so I decided to like, pour into that platform the best that I could. At a certain point, I realized that other drag entertainers were putting out music and I was at the time putting out music as a drag queen. And then I realized there's just so much going on in the world with regards to, in real life, with regards to the trans community that I really need to speak to it because these are my personal experiences and these are the conversations that I'm having with my friends and, you know, when I'm not in drag, the things that I'm seeing happening during the day and on the news and all these things. There was a murder of a trans woman in my neighborhood that was obviously really impactful and affected me. And it made semi-national news. And from that moment on, I was like, I can't talk about like glittering shoes. Music with a message. It's not everybody's tea, but you know, it's there.
Keep it coming. Keep it coming. Let's have some fun. One of the things that I like to do on the podcast is invite the lovely person that I'm speaking to have a fantasy dinner party for five guests. They can be living, they can be dead, they can be LGBTQ+, they can be whatever you want them to be, as long as they're famous so we know who you're talking about, Peppermint. That would help. Who would you pick and why?
Well, it can't be a surprise. I would definitely pick Prince. I would definitely pick, I'm not a religious person in any way, shape, or form, but I would like to have a conversation with actual Jesus.
What would you say to him? I've got to ask, what would you say to Jesus?
I would ask him to reiterate his message right here and right now for everyone, because it's been so distorted and contrived. I would take a picture of him. So that we could get a fresh look, because I think there have been a couple of creative licenses and alterations. I would really try to connect the stories of what we've heard about being Christ-like to what his thoughts are and where we are today. I think it would be beneficial, but you know, that's my opinion. But I would like to hear, you know, from what I've heard, you know, if he was, you know, an anointed person, the Son of God, as they say, and spent time with lepers and prostitutes and all types of people, regardless of their standing, their station, their social standing, would love to hear his connection to those of us that may fit into those groups today, because everyone who seems to be doing the work on his behalf, not everyone, many people who use his name clearly are using it to persecute the same very people that he would have probably been protecting. And so that's why I would want to talk with him. And those are the things I would ask him. But yeah, so Prince, Jesus, Bell Hooks, Janet Jackson.
I've got to say, people need to go and check out your lip sync video of If after this podcast as well, because
that is
a feast for the eyes. That is a masterpiece.
Thank you. And one more person, you know what? Probably Marilyn Monroe, just to wind it out.
That is an iconic dinner party. What is your best ever experience or your most memorable experience, to sort of broaden it out, in an LGBTQ+ safe space, maybe a club or a bar, somewhere where you think, yeah, that was a particular experience?
One of the moments that I have quite a few moments, especially with regards to like me performing, that are really memorable. But I think the one that I felt like the most trans, the most performative, the most like celebrated, the most queer, the most Black, the most me, was the 2000 and something HX Awards, where I won Entertainer of the Year and then proceeded to do a live performance of my song Serving It Up, which was the first song that I ever released. And I recreated the music video on stage. The music video took place in a diner, and I was like a waitress, sort of like Donna Summer, she works hard for the money vibe. And then we recreated that on stage. I like built a bar, like a countertop. It took place in a diner, so it was like a countertop and tables. I built tables. I built a bar. I did all that with my hands, and I had some help. I had this set and then bar stools, and we just recreated the music video right there for people. And people were like losing their minds and screaming and hollering. It was probably, I would imagine, from all the award ceremonies that I had seen in New York, because we had a few different nightlife award ceremonies, It was the most production value that I had ever seen on that stage. And I felt really good about that. And the crowd was like, whoa. And I felt as though I was proving to people why I was deserving that of that year's Entertainer of the Year. And it felt great. And it was at Lincoln Center, which is like an iconic place for the arts.
So it was the perfect moment. Lots of people have danced to your tunes, myself included, but what tune gets Peppermint on the dance floor?
You know, there's a lot. I mean, all it has to really have is a beat, but one of them is a Janet Jackson song, No Surprise. it's called Throb, and it's on her Janet album. It's house music, and it's so good. It really, really gets me going. And the performance of it from on Saturday Night Live really like put it over the top for me. So Throb by Janet Jackson. And then the Thunderpuss remix of Girl from the Gutter by an artist named Kina, who was a replacement in a group called Brownstone, which I think people may have heard of. But the Thunderpuss remix of Girl from the Gutter, which I never hear on the dance floor. So I never get to hear it anymore, but I used to hear it on the dance floor. And Kina is a wonderful vocalist. And it's just so inspiring. The music, the song, her voice, that album.
I don't know that, but I'm going to go and stream it straight away after this. Have you ever done the gay, in inverted commas, holiday? Have you ever done like the destination, like the Fire Island, the gay holiday?
No. Well, yes, but no. I've worked at almost all those destinations. So I've been there, right? Except for P-Town in the United States. I've never worked in P-Town and I've only been there. I just went to like literally drive by it because I was like, I've heard that this is like so much fun. But I worked in Fire Island for many, many years. And so I got a chance to see it all. And I was like, it's not really for me. I do encourage other people to go because it's a wonderland. And I am in love with the like historic sort of aspect of a place like Fire Island being a haven for gay men and eventually gay women and people in the queer community to go and gather like during the 80s, 70s and 80s for sure. 60s, 70s and 80s, I think. If I had to like go on a vacation and like spend a weekend somewhere, it would not be Fire Island. I'm so sorry to say it, y'all. Cause I just need to, it's like going to Times Square. Like I'm a New Yorker. I'm not going to Times Square. And so that's what Fire Island represents for me. I did, however, go to, Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, which is known in the gay circles, as a gay sort of, vacation spot. And I did go there on vacation just a couple of years ago with my transgender girlfriends. And we did not go to a single gay bar. We rented a mansion in the jungle. And we didn't go anywhere near the gays or the straights. We didn't do anything. We just like sat in our mansion and had massage therapists come to us. You know, but that's a certain kind of vacation.
Sounds perfect. Tranquility. Final question for a gay old time. And I think this is going to be quite a difficult one because you have done so many beautiful, proud things in your lifetime so far. And I'm sure there are many to come. You've been a trailblazer on Broadway. You know, you have your own comedy special, Society Effects. Your music, as we mentioned, has been awesome. The Traitors. You've done so many fabulous things. But what is your proudest rainbow flavored moment in your life, Peppermint?
I'd say I don't know, to be honest with you. It's only in moments like this that we get to look back and say and like sort of count the things that we've done. And I'm like, oh, I did do this and I did do that. Like, I don't usually do that because I'm usually like always looking forward and like, what do I have to do? What do I have to do? What do I have to do? God, this is going to sound so like self-indulgent. I had been named as Entertainer of the Year again. And so because of that, I was offered, there was two major gay publications, magazines in New York at a time. HX Magazine and Next Magazine. They were both competitors. And I, had been at various times. The first one that ever put me on the cover was HX Magazine. But at various times, I had been on the cover of either, which is fine. You know, I'm in the community. But this particular Pride, both of them separately called me up and asked me if I would be on the cover. And I said, yes. And I was on the cover. They both came out the same day. I was on the cover. One came out on Thursday, one came out on Friday, but basically the same day. I was on the cover. I was the only person to have ever been on the cover of both of those magazines the same exact time. And I was also on one of their Pride floats. I got disinvited from the other. It was the same offer. But like once they found out that I was on the other competition's magazine, I had to like make a decision about who I was going to get in bed with. And so I ended up being on, I think it was Next Magazine's float. But I was offered the cover of both magazines. And so that was a really proud and very queer moment for me. Like literally during Pride, I was on the cover of both magazines. I was the cover girl. You were not escaping my face.
Nobody wants to. Why be one cover girl when you can be two? Can I say thank you for joining me today, Peppermint? It has been an absolute pleasure. And thank you for proving that your life indeed has been a gay old time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's it for this episode of A Gay Old Time. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Peppermint as much as I did. I think she's such a trailblazing icon. It's incredible. If you'd like to experience more rainbow joy, then please subscribe and follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening right now, maybe on the Gaydio app, and do share it to anyone else you think would love to listen in. If you'd like more information online, then head to the Instagram account at A Gay Old Time Podcast, and you can also find out more at all the www.nigelmay.net. Thanks a million to Juliet at Pineapple Audio Production for making everything so gorgeous and sparkly. I'll be back soon with another episode featuring a deep and meaningful with another inspirational individual. Until then, from me, Nigel May, sending all the love and hoping that whatever you're up to, if it applies to you, that you're having a gay old time. Enjoy.